Hello, this is Pearl Lamb Podcast. I'm really lucky today. I'm very happy that I have Kevin Kwan with me. Kevin, just in case people didn't know about you, which I think very rarely that people won't know about you, can you tell them about yourself?
I wouldn't presume anyone knows anything about me. I'm a writer. I write novels and nonfiction as well, but I'm probably most well known for having written the Crazy Rich Asians novels.
The Crazy Rich Asians has changed the world. And let's start from the beginning. You were Singaporean, living in Texas. How did you, you studied journalism, right?
I did, yeah.
And then from journalism, you then went to Parsons, you study art. And then you have a creative agency, right? And how did it all of a sudden become a writer? Yeah, because you, I think I read about you saying that you were just writing a book for your friends and you did not realize that it can be a really popular book, commercially successful book, and change your whole culture.
That is very true. But if we rewind it to the beginning, I very much was a writer from the very beginning. As a child, I always loved to write stories.
You love reading, right?
Reading and writing and all that. And then, of course, I went to in college, I majored in journalism, media studies, and literature. So I was always learning about writing, training to be a writer, but you couldn't make a living doing it. Mm. Especially what I did. I wrote experimental poetry. Right?
I love experimental poetry.
I actually also did art criticism. My first published work was an art review.
Wow.
Of the Art Guys. I don't even remember the Art Guys.
Yes, right? I remember.
So yeah, I reviewed one of their shows in Houston, Texas, right?
But you paid peanuts for it.
Well, no, you were paid nothing. Not even peanuts,
Oh my God.
So you couldn't make a career as a writer. So I completely had to pivot to something else. And I moved to New York and did something far more practical. I went to art school. You're supposed to laugh here.
Art school, practical. Art school.
I wasn't thinking practically. I didn't have any guidance, So I just made up my own world, right? Of how.
And your parents did not,
My parents did not care.
You're lucky.
I was very lucky in the sense that there was so much benign neglect. And I benefited from that. I benefited from the fact that my parents were very atypical and they were not tiger parents at all.
Surprising. Chinese, not tiger parents?
It is, but it is not if you knew the background of my family, from Singapore. And, my parents were both very artistic souls in their own way.
And I read that your father is a qualified architect.
He is not.
He's not a qualified architect.
He studied architecture.
He studied architecture.
He never finished. And then
why?
I think at a certain point he pivoted to engineering. He was at University of Sydney. He did architecture for a few years. Then engineering was the hot thing to do in the late 50s, early 60s, So
there's a lot of engineering in China. All 50s and above.
But his heart was always in something, I think, far more creative. Because he drew like nobody's business. He could do portraits and paintings and his sisters, So I know that there is, genetically, I come from a very artistic branch, because I see my aunts, they were all such gifted artists, and I had a natural talent for drawing and painting and all that kind of thing. But once again, going to art school, you can't make a living doing it, right? So it's a passion, but I had to find a way to really bridge the gap. And I fell into this world of design consulting, right? Because I knew how to combine words with imagery. So I could work for magazines, I could work for websites, I could work for publishers and do beautiful visual books, And so I became this specialist. I did a book for Elizabeth Taylor, the book about her jewelry collection. I worked with architects, David Rockwell, people like that,
me about your book is you wrote it in such a witting, so not Chinese. Chinese are supposedly write very seriously, like Hajing and all that. And your book, lighthearted, savvy, and lots of pop culture, and you hold your book and you don't want to put it down. And
Thank
it's witty and lots of humor.
Yeah.
Now, this is a part of Chinese that is not typical. We do have that part. We do have a part of frivolity, but...
It's just not amplified.
Absolutely.
Of your generation, my generation, we were taught to behave.
Yes.
We were taught, you know, you were taught to be a lady,
yeah.
You know, and I was taught to be a gentleman. So you're never allowed to really be sarcastic.
No.
Sarcasm is seen as rude.
Of course.
Right?
Of course.
And
your whole book is a satire.
It's, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's just great because I said, when I'm reading it, I mean, I remember the first time I heard about the book, I was in Singapore. Mm-hmm. And my staff in Singapore was saying, did you read the book? Do you know who this is? Do you know who this is? They were all guessing which other character you were referring to. That was really great.
Thank you.
That was fantastic. That's.
And that would have never happened, I think, if I hadn't left Singapore
and come to America and gone
to American high school. Sort of been integrated into American pop culture.
Not just that.
Right, I think.
You need to be confident. Mm-hmm. I mean, to write this, to laugh at your own culture, this is self-deprecating humor.
And I think I had the confidence of knowing that I could write whatever I wanted because it would never be published. You know, which is why I tell other writers and artists these days, just go for it.
Really,
you know, zero in on your truth. And tell it like it is. Because once you start censoring yourself, that's really the death of art.
Yeah.
You know?
Because what I really love about when I read it is I can see your confidence. And you are actually talking about the society that the West has no knowledge of it. And that reflection is great because you change the whole impression about Asians. Because you give that importance to the Asians. Mm-hmm. But when you were writing it, did you think about it? That wasn't your aim, right?
You know, it was kind of a spiritual goal. You know what I mean? I really noticed a gap. You know, when you went to bookshops, you never saw any books, any fiction based on contemporary Asia.
No.
You would see historical Asia, right? You know, books about the rape of Nanking.
Yeah.
Shanghai in the 30s, things like that. Or you would see stories that were very specific to the Asian American immigrant experience, right?
Yeah. Joy Luck Club.
And Joy Luck Club, Maxine Hong Kingston.
Yeah.
Amazing writers who were telling their truth at a time, you know. But I think I was part of a new generation where I grew up in the East. I grew up in Singapore. And I think the first 11 years of my life were so important. I see it now because I grew up feeling empowered. You know, my role models were successful, attractive, vibrant Asian people.
Exactly.
Right? And I think that makes all the difference in the world. And then also Singapore in the 70s and early 80s, you know, like Hong Kong, was so international.
Absolutely.
Right? And our friends were British, New Zealanders, Australians, Indians, some Americans, actually fewer Americans, but it was very international.
It is.
And so I had no problem mingling with other cultures and getting to know people, right? And you learn from a very early age always how to behave around adults, how to speak to adults.
Yeah.
So, you know, that gave me the advantage when I came to the U.S. I wasn't a fish out of water. I could immediately start swimming and continue my journey of exploration, right?
Confidence.
Yeah.
Confidence.
And I think that was key.
That
had I grown up here, I think I would have had a very different experience growing up as a minority from day one. You know, what it does to your psyche. It's something I'm only beginning to understand in the last few years as I really delve in more into Asian American culture.
So
right?
Do you actually recognize or aware that there has been or there still is racial discrimination when you were at school?
Absolutely. Absolutely, there was discrimination, but
I didn't
even see it.
I didn't feel it. I didn't feel it when I was in England. I did not feel it at all. And I was the only Chinese.
Yeah, I was one of three other Asian kids in my high school. But I also, you know, it's about seeing the glass half full of half empty.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you go looking for the problems, you will find them. And I think I had a natural confidence where I wasn't looking for the problems. I wasn't looking for the insults or the slights or feeling like, you know, I was already a weird kid. I was already a small, tiny kid, right? So I had to just really sort of stand out from day one. Right?
So today, do you consider yourself as an Asian or American or American Chinese or a Singaporean? I don't really think
in terms of those labels.
Yeah, like me. I don't feel labels at all.
Like
I feel that I'm an international person.
Same here.
And also I feel that I'm a bridge, it's like you, that I recognize, you know, our own culture, something that we can laugh about it, and that the West didn't know.
Yeah.
And therefore they should recognize.
If there's anything I'm most proud to call myself, I always called myself, I'm a New Yorker, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think being a New Yorker is a state of mind.
Mm-mm-mm.
It's a way of being. It's an attitude. Of course, now I live in LA more than I live in New York. But still, you know, it's that I identify with that tribe of other creative souls, right? But of course I'm Asian. Of course I'm Singaporean. Of course I'm Asian American. I'm all those things. But I don't want to be labeled just one thing.
Absolutely right.
You know,
I agree.
And
I
thankfully have never had to really contend with that.
You have actually changed, I mean, the culture, especially in Hollywood, right? Your Crazy Rich Asian, that movie, it was the second movie or the second Chinese cast movie?
Third. Ever.
And so you actually jumpstart even Michelle's movie Everywhere.
Everything Everywhere
All
At Once.
Everything Everywhere. Where, because without your movie, you won't have another Chinese cast movie. You must be so proud that you actually create these changes, this transformation.
I mean, I feel very gratified that, you know, my books and my movie help to light a fire that other amazing creative people have continued to build on. So that much I'm very proud of. But I still think we're in very early days, right?
Absolutely
right. The fact that you can only name a few movies.
Yeah.
How many billion Asians are there around the world and even in the U.S.? You know what I mean? Like, you know, we are still very underrepresented in modern culture.
But even though, I mean, recently, when we talk about diversity, one sees that Hollywood has actually have other nationality, other race in most of the movies. And of course now the new administration is against DEI and all that. Has Hollywood changed following this new?
I think Hollywood in a way has always been at the forefront of change.
Mm.
And I still see amazing projects happening that do showcase diversity.
Because
you know what I mean? I look, you know, I have a TV show working,
in the works.
I have movies in the works, Broadway musical. So, like, none of that has changed, so.
I understand that Crazy Rich Asians is coming to Broadway, and it's also, there's a TV show.
Yes.
Show. When is it?
Hopefully we start going into production, you know, next year on the TV show or later this year, right?
Wow.
And Broadway is a 10-year process.
10 years?
10 years, yes. We're in year 5 or 6 at this point.
So long.
You know, you think about it, right? So many things have to happen.
Music.
Music, lyrics, choreography, costumes, staging.
Wow.
And then also, you know, on Broadway, there's only 30 theaters. Right?
Wow.
So it's a game of another show has to leave before they can actually install.
Wow.
So
it's
the
amazing.
Real estate is very precious. You understand that.
Yeah. How about that is on your trilogy, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And how about your two new books?
Those are also being adapted into films.
Wow.
So Sex and Vanity and Lies and Weddings.
Sex and Vanity and Lies and Marriage.
Lies and Weddings. Yeah.
Lies and Weddings.
Close.
Yeah.
You're close. Yeah. So those are with different studios, you know.
Different studio.
Yeah.
And, oh, you are busy here.
I am quite busy. Yeah.
Are you writing next book?
I'm really hoping to start writing this year, a new book.
But yeah. You often take a few years before.
I do. Because, you know, I always feel like you have to, number one, refuel your tank.
Yeah, of course, and, of course.
You know, like it or not, my books are really based so much on observation, right? So I have to live. I have to experience things in order
have you been back to Asia
to write
recently?
About. I was in Asia last year, yeah. So I was in Hong Kong.
You didn't even call me when you're in Hong Kong. You didn't even send me a message.
But I thought you lived in London.
No, I live around. I'm in Hong Kong, London, Shanghai. Yeah. I don't know where I am most of the time.
Next time for sure.
Next time you must. You must. Yeah. So
I don't like to bother people. You know that.
This is not bother.
And you know what it's like when you go back to Asia. You have to see so many relatives and this and that. I didn't have time to actually see many friends at all. It was nonstop.
Do you still have relatives in Hong Kong?
Tons.
Hong Kong as
tons,
well?
Yeah.
I thought all your relatives is in Singapore.
Singapore and Hong Kong. I mean, my grandfather grew up in Hong Kong.
Wow.
So he's one of the Hong Kong Kwans. You know, that's why he's Nancy Kwan is his cousin, right? So it's, you know. So
you're related to Nancy Kwan.
Yeah, she's my cousin. Mm. So a lot of Kwans.
That's why you can write about biracial.
Well, that's one reason, but
Eurasians.
I also, I have many, many cousins who are also biracial.
All Eurasians.
Yes.
Wonderful. So next book, would it be about Asians?
I mean, the next book is really part of this trilogy of new books that I write about, beginning with Sex and Vanity, which is about Asians outside of Asia.
Outside Asia.
It's really about the collision of East and West, right? So the first book was about a biracial Asian American living in New York. The most recent book, Lies and Weddings, is about a British Chinese girl,
Chinese
and a British Chinese family.
And so about the boy
who's trying to find
the right marriage.
Exactly. So,
but I thought that was really funny because you pinpoint the right thing. You know, now it's not about just women. Men is doing the same thing. And this time, you actually give a lot of importance to the father. So all your books before, you talk a lot about strong mothers. And also, it changed the stereotype of how the West always think that Asian women are very subservient. You actually changed this whole perception about that, which was...
Because as you know, the women rule, right? In Asian families, in Chinese families especially, the mother, the grandmother is the queen.
Of course.
Right?
Yeah.
So the men...
I love it.
And the men just submit.
Yeah,
right?
But this time, I thought it was very, you know, you absolutely change another direction. You put more importance on the father.
I felt that was important to do for this story. And to also really give a chance, you know, this is definitely much more focused on the male protagonist, right? It's Rufus. He's the one. He's the Cinderella that has to find the glass slipper for his own foot. You know what I mean? So I'm turning the tables on that, right? And also looking at father-son relationships, father-daughter relationships. You know, that was important for me to really kind of examine in this book.
Okay, define for me love.
Oh my gosh.
Define for me, because all your stories is all a lot about love, but love is always mixed with wealth, right? So what is to you a perfect love story? All right.
Cinderella? I wouldn't even be able to answer that. I think there's so many forms of love, right? And there's
now we are talking about a boy and girl. I mean your story about boys and girls is always money plays a very important part, whether it's positive or negative. Of course, in the real world, it's like that.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, you know, my books are satire, right?
Yeah,
they're satire, and they are emphasizing, you know, these characters that live in a very rarefied world where money does matter.
To
at least one of the people involved, or the families that are involved. You know, if you look at my...
You always have to... Yeah,
exactly.
It's all about family.
In my most recent book, you know, the boy and girl really don't care about money, but they're forced into caring by the family. You know, Rufus is forced because he's the heir to a title and a grand estate, and he has to be able to fund his estate for future generations,
This is
so
British,
that's a sense of the duty he has, right? Not only the British duty, but the Asian son duty,
where his
mother is pressuring him, like, you have to continue the family name, you have to give me grandchildren, you have to do all this. So he feels that tie, you know, and it's stifling in many ways. It's claustrophobic, but he's trying to navigate his own personal happiness, and he wants to be an artist. I don't know if you know that in the book, right? He's actually a struggling, starving, no, not starving, but he's he's trying to make it as a painter.
Making it to be a painter is very painful.
Yes.
But the way that, I think the way that you're speaking about family, you know, Asians is all about family. So it is that culture, this is the way that you brought people to recognize how important this Confucius influence on our culture. Whether you are American Chinese, or whether you're British Chinese, or whether you are Asians from Asia, that family structure unit is really the core of everything. But money, so we're talking about a
revival. Money complicates it.
Yeah,
money always complicates the
complicated.
Family.
So now I'm asking you, Kevin, in the real world, in the real Kevin's world, is money important? Is money or love important?
Wow. You know, I think both are important, right? I mean, you know, you need, on a very practical level, money to survive, to live. But I think you also need love to thrive.
Yes.
And, you know, I think, you know, to me, I think love is the most important thing of all.
Of course, right? The love gives you that confidence.
Exactly. So, you know, I think it's very much a duality, right? In fact, I was actually thinking of calling the book Love and Money. Believe it or not, right? But I thought Lies and Weddings was actually a little more interesting.
I would say that you are this younger generation of writers who is actually integrating with pop culture. And that's why you resonate with the West, with the Western, with the readers in the West in such a profound manner.
You give them something they can actually understand.
Yeah.
When you're introducing things that are very new and very exotic, right? So it's that combination that sort of allows people to really go into that world.
Yeah, so... You
know? So, but I think that's how world culture has changed, right? Even in the East, even in Asia, you know, the kids are so westernized these days,
of
right?
Of course they are, yeah.
And so it works both ways, right?
So when you go back to... When you return to Asia, you do get along with all your cousins and all your relatives in Asia.
Very much so. And I think I very much enjoy getting to know them and getting to know what their lives are like, because it's so vastly different from my life. You know, I left the clan, right? And I think in America, you are much more alone, right? You know, my family was much more alone. Right, it was just my parents, my brothers. Here we are in the middle of Texas, right? And you don't have this gigantic clan around you.
Why did your family choose Texas?
You're going to have to ask my dad that.
I mean, it's so weird. Texas.
In a way, it was the worst thing that could have happened and the best thing that could have happened, because it really allowed me to be in a whole different alien territory where I could really actually learn a new way of thriving, you know, and really kind of find my creativity. Because I really always say this, if I had stayed in Singapore, right,
How about if your parents moved to San Francisco or LA or New York?
I think that would have been different too, right? Because then I would have had so much more exposure to culture.
Yeah.
But being in Houston, I felt so isolated. I felt like I was in the desert. And so my goal was move to New York, go to art school, go to Parsons from day one. I was like, I have to get out of here, right? And New York to me is the answer. If I can't go back to Singapore, I'm going to aim for New York.
Okay.
And that became the goal. And I achieved the goal.
So
right?
When you were in New York, what makes you the most... what makes you excited about New York when you're actually living there?
Wow.
Not a dream, okay? Just living there.
From the day I moved to New York, you know, having one friend, literally knowing one person.
Only one friend.
Only one person. I actually slept on her sofa, right? The first week I was there as I was enrolling in art school. And then I from there moved into a dormitory, right? When I went to Parsons. Mm-hmm. Within, I would say a week, I had made 30 new friends.
Wow.
Who are still my friends to this day.
Amazing.
So it was, you know, it took me in 1 week, I could make 30 friends. In Houston, it took me 10 years to make 10 friends. And that had nothing to do with the color of my skin, can I just tell you? That was just connecting with who I felt, people that were truly part of my tribe, which is the tribe of creatives. And going to art school, you know.
Yeah, you have
being able to just sit up at night in your dorm room drinking cappuccino as you're working on a painting and being able to reference, you know, Giacometti or Gautier without anyone questioning you, right, was my freedom. To find your tribe and say, oh my God, do you want to go to MoMA tomorrow and see the Robert Frank show, right? Versus in Houston, most of the time, that would have been weird. Right? You couldn't say that going to a normal American high school. So that was what I connected to, I think, being in art school with other artistic kids.
Oh, that's great, because you're speaking the same language and you were understood.
I was finally understood and finally seen. Right?
Wow.
Versus, I think, in Houston for the first 10 years, in many ways, I had to just sort of hide, right? And pretend to be many things.
But how, Houston, you have a really great museum there.
Now.
Oh, only now.
Now.
Because the Museum of Houston is amazing.
The Manil, I think, started in 86 or 87 or maybe even 88. Mm. Before that, it was a private collection, right?
Ah.
And that changed everything. Because even in college, when I first started going to college, I loved being in downtown Houston. The Museum of Fine Arts, the Manil,
exactly.
That became my haven, right? And then I was really part of the poetry scene, the experimental, poetry slam scene, that. Yes, but I wanted more, right? That was still such a small community. And I knew I needed more than that, right? So I loved what Houston did for me because it nurtured me. It allowed me to sort of grow and nurture my talent. Because I think if I'd moved at age 11 to New York, it would have been overwhelming. It would have been too much too soon, right? So I had these 10 years to really kind of develop and mature and really kind of also figure out how to live in America, right?
Exactly. As a young Asian boy.
Exactly.
Going to Texas, to high school.
Yeah.
And you're
so
into
in many
art
ways,
and
it,
creativity.
It kept me.
Tough.
It kept me safe, And, it was not a cultural wasteland.
So
that's not what I'm saying, but I was very lucky, because I think my father was very, very supportive.
You're really, really lucky.
One of the things he did for me when I was a teenager was, he bought me a Salvador Dali.
What?
Lithograph.
What?
And I was 12 years old, and that was the first.
What?
Piece that of art that I owned. You know what I mean?
That is impressive.
Because
Chinese parents. Unheard of.
Really unheard of.
I think in the West, you wouldn't understand how Chinese parents are. Chinese parents, up to today, now today is a bit better, but my generation, our parents never encouraged.
So your parents didn't do that? Yeah.
No, never encouraged any of the children to touch anything on art and culture.
Hmm.
It's amazing to even.
So art was your rebellion.
I chose art because I didn't need to study.
Yeah.
Was
your family Cantonese or from Shanghai?
My mother is Shanghainese.
Okay.
My father is from Suatou, Chouzhou.
Okay. Yeah.
Chouzhou. Okay. So
fantastic food.
Fantastic
food. I love these guys.
If you come next time to Hong Kong, I take you to Chouzhou. And the other place which is very good is a Xiamen.
Yeah. No, Xiamen's. I've heard. Exactly. That's where my grandmother's family is from.
Oh, really?
Xiamen, yeah.
So
they called it Amoy back in those days.
So
right?
Do you speak Hokkien or do you speak Cantonese?
I speak none of it. unfortunately. But I can understand some of Hokkien.
Hold on first. When you were here at 11 years old, before 11 years old at home, what do you speak?
English.
You don't speak any Chinese?
No. I spoke a bit of Cantonese because my nanny was Cantonese. But at home, we spoke English. My parents only spoke English. Yeah, my parents don't speak a word of Mandarin.
My Mandarin is so bad that I, you know, I love it myself.
And then with my grandparents, also English. So, you know, my grandfather was very Anglophile, right? So, and he went to school in Scotland.
So at home, you speak English?
English,
because most of the home, because in Singapore, you usually speak
Hokkien or Cantonese. Yeah.
Cantonese, and then Malaysia usually is all Cantonese. Yeah.
Like I told you, our family was very much an outlier, right? We were very, very English.
Wow.
And, you know, and so growing up, we were, even in Singapore, I felt sort of we were different in the sense that, you know, my grandfather was so British. He smoked a pipe every night, you know, and he spoke with a British accent. And then my father, you know, spent most of his time in Australia, right? He was educated there, went to boarding school, went to college there. So he was already very westernized in his outlook. And I think he very much wanted that for his own children, right? Like he never bought into Singapore society. I think he never quite fit in, quite frankly. He was so much happier in Texas. When he was out of all that.
And how about
I think that reminded him more of Australia, right?
And how about your other relative? They still like that glamour, that society, see?
I wouldn't say they like it. I think it's just when it's just part
it's
of your
way
life.
It's a way of life.
They don't see it as glamorous. In fact, they always ask me, you know, they're like, who are these people you're writing about? Like, who are these, all these rich people? You know, we don't know these rich people. And I'm just like, I don't know what to say.
It.
Like,
I love it.
Look at all your maids. Look at your driver. I don't know what to say. You know how it is though, right?
Do they change the impression of you when you are a very successful and well-known personality? Do they recognize that, and have they behaved differently towards you?
I don't think they really behave differently. I think, you know, I'm still...
And were they proud? At least they're proud.
Yeah, you know how also Asians never really say much?
No, they know.
Right?
No, so, even they're proud.
Yeah. So, you know.
But they will have a little smile.
Maybe. They've always been polite. They're still polite. But I don't really sense a huge difference. When I was visiting Thailand, my aunt came to one of my events.
Yeah.
So that was nice. You know what I mean?
That's great.
And I was told by her children, oh, she never goes anywhere.
Oh,
but
that's
she
great.
Actually ventured out into a crowd to come to one of your events. So I think in their way, they're very supportive.
In their way, they're proud.
Yeah, but I think, you know, they're not the type to emote and gush over you and say, you're so, you know. No, this is not. They don't ever want to puff up
your
ego.
This is very American.
Exactly.
I mean, Chinese doesn't.
No.
No. But you can see from their smile, right?
Perhaps, you know, or maybe they're horrified. I don't know.
And how about yourself? You know. Yourself. How, I mean, the last 10 years.
I feel very lucky. I feel incredibly lucky in the sense that I've been able to really achieve many of my dreams, right? Just the fact that I'm able to live a creative life and make a living with my creativity. I never imagined that would happen. Right. I always thought, you know, I'm doing these practical things. I do consulting. I do this. But then that allows me to do some of my artistic projects. But now I can full time be involved in writing books, you know, making TV shows, making movies, helping to influence culture, you know, helping to influence a whole new generation of writers
and really bravo.
Even artists, you know. I think there was a collector that was exoticizing what they were seeing in China or in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, exactly.
They saw it as just one exotic element.
Yeah, the whole Asia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, I'm going to, you know, have a, you know, one of these paintings. And they would cherry pick from that.
Mm.
But I think what's happening now in emerging contemporary art in the U.S. or in the West is that there's a whole new generation of Asian American
exactly.
and Asian European artists, you know, who are doing dynamic, amazing
I
work,
think so. I think they have done a lot. But
influenced a bit by their culture, but that's no longer the main issue.
It's not the issue.
They've moved beyond
because
that.
Because for me,
yeah,
art is not about passport.
Yeah.
I really don't care what passport you're holding. Mm-hmm. Most important thing is they are great artists. There are works that I love. Yeah. Other people doesn't like it, but it needs to be accessible for me. So I really don't look at passport as such.
Yeah.
And I just hope that, you know, in your writer scene as well, as a writer, I really hope that it's the same. Do you feel that?
I think it's changing. And I think we need more of a critical mass of writers who are of Asian descent, right?
Yeah.
To tell their stories, to transcend the culture.
To transcend the culture.
Where it doesn't become just, oh, I'm reading this person because they're from Singapore or they're from Malaysia or they're from Korea. You know, you want these stories to become just so universal, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, this is all what we are looking for,
yeah.
Right? Right.
Because people don't read Harry Potter because he's British and it's a British author. You know what I mean? So it's like, when are we going to get to that phase? But I think you need more of these artists,
I'm
right?
I'm hoping that
to normalize.
You are going to write books eventually, not just about Asians.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, because it's... You know, books itself is a content. The content today, yes, is interesting because people are learning about a different, you know, different sort of Chinese culture or Asian cultures that they have never confronted. But eventually, as a writer, I mean, I hope that you will be writing and exploring other issues.
I'm trying to, right? And I'm trying to create characters that are so full-bodied that readers can immerse in their worlds and their race and the color of their skin becomes irrelevant.
Yes.
Right? They are just interesting people.
They're interesting people. And I hope the world...
living and breathing
exactly.
their lives, and you really feel into their soul and their problems.
Exactly.
And it transcends their race or their
this
culture.
Is, this
That's
is
at the heart of it.
Yeah.
But that very much... It does inform who they are. You know, we are a product of our families
and our
experiences. So how can we work with that? Like, how can we use that creative tension? And yet it's not that's not the sum of, you know, that's not just all it is, right? There's much more than that, right?
But you're right, because we are educated with a Western syllabus. The culture, I mean, we actually grew up in a Western culture. And obviously, when you look at
things... I mean, you and I certainly both did, right? We grew up in a culture that was colonized by the British.
Yeah, exactly,
right?
Exactly. And definitely, we're looking at things in the Western lens. Yeah. Whether we accept it or not, it is. But
which is why it was so important for me in Lies and Weddings. You know, it's my recolonization.
Yeah, that is very important.
Of taking
important.
This
Absolutely.
British family, and I'm like, no, but I'm putting a whole Chinese family in there, right? You're going to get a Chinese mother. You're going to have half Chinese kids.
Mm.
And, you know, and there very much are real families. There are real families where in the British aristocracy now where there are, you know, they've intermarried, right? But this is the reality of the world. And that's why I always say, like, the more specific you make it to your culture, the more universal it becomes.
I like this sentence.
You know.
I like this
sentence. People can really connect to the truth of who this character is, who this family is, right? When you really personalize it and the story is about them in their little world, in their little village. The village might be in China or the village might be in England. But
British
it's still
village, yeah.
this little world, right? But someone in Pakistan can read it and go, oh my gosh, this character is just like my cousin.
Yeah.
And, you know what I mean?
And I'm sure that...
Snobbery, no matter where you are.
I mean, the family that you've been writing, I'm sure that it happens in an Indian family and a British or American family. Happens.
Exactly. And when they see that, that is how we create understanding, right? And that's how we begin to demystify, and that's how we begin to shatter stereotypes.
Yeah.
When people can say, we're all human, right? We're all here having a human experience, expressing our human truths.
On this note, I have to say thank you, Kevin. And it's a beautiful, I mean, it's beautiful ending, human note.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me.
Always a pleasure,
Thank
Pearl.
Thank you.